Wicked problems are the ones where the rules change while you're trying to solve the problem. The ground shifts from underfoot. Chasms open up. New requirements get added. New threats show. Like, everything is changing around you and you have to navigate. The industry cares about finding evil, finding it fast, and getting it off the network. And our ability to do that consistently, faster than you can deliver a pizza, is pretty much unmatched. AI is the most overhyped, but also the most underhyped at the same time. You're not going to lose your job to AI, but you will lose your job to somebody who knows AI better than you do.
Welcome to Secure Access with John Dillard, your front door to the future of compliance, security, and tech. Powered by Sign-In Solutions, we bring you bold conversations with industry leaders who are shaping how organizations protect people, data, and spaces. If you're serious about smarter, safer access, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Yannick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's good to see you again.
It's always fun to talk to people who I've worked with closely. You were on my board of ThreatSwitch for years. I think we met in 2016, roughly. And then you were an advisor in 2017 first.
Yeah.
Yep. And then joined the board. Yeah. Is
that
right?
That's right.
So this is awesome. It's really great. And you've had a lot go on. I mean, you know, you built Expel, but what I really would love to start with before we get to Expel, and we'll spend a lot of time on that, is, and it's the first question I ask everybody, which is, how in the world did you get here? Because often it's accidental. It's not necessarily what you thought you'd be doing. But what's the origin story of Yannick Korf and the career that you built?
How early do you want me to go?
Back before I was.
We've been a lot of time on this.
You can start as early as you like.
I have a technical background, so I'm a computer science major. And the reason I did that is because even as a kid growing up, I knew I had strong introvert roots. And I thought, you know, if I could work with technology, then I won't have to work with people and it'll be great.
If not for the people, all this would be very easy, you know.
I know, if not for the people. And obviously things went horribly wrong, right? Because I'm running a business which is filled with people. But that was the idea. And so that gave me my technical roots. And unlike, I think, a lot of security people, I was not drawn to security in the practitioner side right out of the gate. I fell into it, to your point, very accidentally. I started off in a company doing software risk management, and I was doing IT work. I then ended up doing a bunch of research in their research group for these DARPA contracts on Java bytecode analysis, trying to figure out malicious components of software systems. Super interesting work, much more programming oriented. That was really good. But shortly tilted out of that into systems work. So I ran infrastructure back when people ran infrastructure pre-cloud, if you remember those days.
That was a long time ago.
We invented
new words now that we didn't have then.
100%. And you no doubt remember the .com boom and bust, which I think we're paralleling a little bit these days. But so I started off, you know, very much in IT, sort of security adjacent. I went to I'll throw out another name that you may not have heard for a while. AOL, those folks.
I hear the noise. Like, I had a BS when I was, I think, in high school or college. And then AOL was disrupted the whole BBS scene because they had a picture after you dialed up.
Exactly. We won't talk too much about the chat rooms.
When did you start at AOL?
I would have been 2004. And I actually joined their security team. So I moved from being, you know, a security IT person in a security company to a security person in an IT company. I think by the time I got through, I was at AOL for 5.5 years. I missed the good years of AOL, I think. We're building the internet, we're bringing America online. I sort of missed that. And it was really sort of managing the decline. But really good place to work, really great people to work with, learned a ton. That's where I moved into a management role, took some time off, got a graduate degree, came back. And shortly after that, had the opportunity to go build a business at Mandiant for the first time. I followed somebody that I'd worked with before over to Mandiant, built their managed service, which at the time was called MDR, so Managed Detection and Response, really focused on 24/7 operations, specifically against nation state actors. That was really our focus. Everybody knew Mandiant for the IR practice, which was sort of a sister business unit. I built one right next to it for the more proactive, hey, maybe before you get breached, you ought to do some things. So that was our 24/7 capability that I built from the ground up. But did that through the acquisition by FireEye and then met you shortly afterwards and started Expel in 2016.
Yeah, I think you had just exited Mandiant when that happened.
Yes.
Which is really interesting. Yeah. All this went down in Northern Virginia because we met through Mach 37. And your story with AOL is interesting to me because, of course, everybody associates the internet with the Bay Area. But, you know, especially in, you know, early to mid 2000s, I mean, all of the infrastructure was sitting in Reston. I'm just curious from your perspective, I mean, you know, having kind of watched that DC, Northern Virginia, you know, ecosystem change over time, it always felt to me a little bit like it lost traction around the same time AOL did. Like everything shifted out west. And I don't know why that is. I mean, the talent was there. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on how that all went down.
You know, I think the whole sort of dot-com thing had a boom and bust period here that was really centered on the East Coast. And I pushed a lot of those companies away or out of business. So if you think about the companies that built the internet, I mean, from a technical, like hardwire standpoint, yeah. Global Crossing, WorldCom, anymore, right? The amount of capital that they invested burying lines and standing up data centers and really just the capital to build the internet was enormous. And I think they saw the promise for what was going to come. It just didn't come as fast as they thought it would. And they couldn't hang around long enough to see the rise. But on the back of those giants, you saw Google, Amazon, and Facebook, and Netflix riding the coattails of that infrastructure. And a lot of that innovation was happening out west.
Yeah, yeah. And it would, none of that stuff would happen if it hadn't been for the pipes. Which it brings me to a question I want to come back to later, which is the physical attack surface and how that relates to the digital attack surface. But I'll hold that question until we get more into MDR and some of the other threat environment things that we want to cover. But, you know, talk a little bit about the shift from AOL to Mandiant. I mean, AOL was fairly mature, I guess, when you were there. Mandiant, yeah, you were there from very early days. Like, you co-founder, right? So,
no, I founded the business unit there, but the company already existed. So they had a product business unit, services business unit, and I built the managed one.
But what is your take on, as a technical leader, making that shift from a big company to a small one in your career? What were the things that you learned that maybe made, you know, all of Mandiant possible? And then, of course, the sale to FireEye and starting Expel.
Yeah, so I had fortunately had a little bit of that experience before. I mentioned earlier I was at this security company doing IT work. It was a small company, 100 people. You might know it. It was called Cigital out here in Sterling, Virginia. They got acquired by Synopsys. I'm sure you're familiar with Synopsys. And that was a great place to work, but small, right? 100 people, startup, and predominantly consulting organization, did a bunch of research work, government contracts, and was trying to get a product part of their business going. Tremendously enjoyable experience. I learned all the things I liked about small companies there. I also worked at Atlantic, actually, right out of college. I don't talk about it much because it didn't last long. but discovered very quickly some things I didn't like about big companies, you know?
I couldn't, you know, I don't think, I'm not very employable anymore. I'm not sure about you, but you get involved in the early stage stuff, you tend to be so allergic to some of those things. Although some big companies, I'm sure, do it very well. I just don't think there are very many of them. Which I have to bring up one thing about where I connected with you when we met in 2017. I was like, oh yeah, I need this guy on my board. It was an operational thing. And I remember talking about it. And I started going off on manager tools for whatever reason about running my team. And I only had like 3 people at the time. It's not like we had much of a team to manage. And then I discovered that you were this deep expert and devotee and cultist of manager tools like I was. What you just mentioned reminds me of, you know, good team management is probably good team management regardless of company size. Tell everybody a little bit about manager tools because I like to work it into conversation whenever I can. And now I can use you as my podcast guest to evangelize for manager tools.
Yeah, that makes it really easy. So I discovered manager tools. It's a dark part of my story, I guess. As I said, technical background, wanted to work with computers, didn't want to work with people. And I was in a staff meeting in 2005, I want to say. So I'd been at AOL for a year at that point. And my manager walked into the room and he says, well, I just want to let everybody know that I've given in my 2 weeks notice. And we were all shocked. Like none of us saw it coming. And then everybody looked at me.
Right at you.
I mean, and I'm like, why are you staring at me? Stop it. It makes me uncomfortable. And the team sort of convinced me to put my hat in the ring for this role, which I did. I ended up getting the role, and that probably began the 2 most difficult years of my life. Like, I was not wired for managing people, working with people, understanding people. that was not the thing that I did. I really struggled with it. I made a bunch of mistakes in the early days. And it wasn't until, I want to say, a year into that journey when I discovered manager tools, I was sort of looking around for how do I do this job? How to work effectively with people. There's hundreds and hundreds of books out there, but nothing so prescriptive for somebody as dense as I am to understand how to work with people. And manager tools, I think, was fundamentally different and really changed that. It was like, look, here's the problem that you're trying to solve. This is what you should go do. And this is why you do it this way. And here's all the other mistakes people make and why that doesn't work out. Each podcast was crisp and to the point and actionable and behavior oriented and ideal for a technical person like me to really understand, oh, okay, well, here's the recipe book. These are the steps I need to take. This is how I go execute this stuff. And I just did it. Takes practice, but it fundamentally changed the trajectory of my career.
That's awesome. I learned to love it. I mean, it was one of those things where, especially as a relatively non-technical person managing technical resources, and this applies to security too, by the way, even the non-cyber, you know, security, broadly speaking, is a wonky technical thing, even if you're doing things like physical security. I mean, it's just it's a weird job. And how do you build teams of these weirdos and all, including myself, and get everybody aligned doing the same thing and communicate effectively? And it's wonderful. So even with the straight security folks that I talk to, I will, especially the one-on-one sample, I was like, this is how you need to have one-on-ones with your team. Like, you need to do this right now. And it works beautifully. So it's just funny that you say you don't work well with people, because I don't, your job title, I think, is COO, if I'm not mistaken, of Expel, usually involves working with people. So you must be good at it, despite yourself.
It does involve working with people. And I think if you ask the people around me, they'd be like, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Sometimes he doesn't.
So let's jump into the Expel story. So you've sold Mandiant. I think you stayed on with Mandiant for what, about a year or two?
Post the acquisition by FireEye, I think I was there for about a year and a half.
All right, that's the same with me as my last job. That's about how long people typically stay after an acquisition. So that's that tracks. Yeah. And then you leave, take a little break, and then you start Expel. So tell everybody a little bit about Expel, what it's about, why you did it, what got you started, why you think it's special. You would only start something, in my experience, if you think it's going to be special. If you don't get excited about it, it's pretty hard. So tell us about it.
So there's a couple of things I got excited about. I got excited about the opportunity in terms of, weirdly, the people. So there's two parts to it. Have you read the book Range by David Epstein?
Heard of it.
So there's this concept in the book I really like. He describes wicked problems where you have, I don't remember what the opposite of wicked problems are, like regular problems, but regular problems have rules. And the rules are consistent and nothing changes out from under your feet. It's sort of a little more predictable. Like chess, really challenging. But predictable rules, it's not like the board grows on you suddenly. New pieces show up that aren't supposed to. It's kind of rigid in the way that it works. Wicked problems are the ones where the rules change while you're trying to solve the problem. The ground shifts from underfoot. Chasms open up. New requirements get added. New threats show. Like, everything is changing around you and you have to navigate. And the security industry is nothing but wicked problems wall to wall. And having worked at Mandiant and watching nation state attackers break into organizations and really wreak havoc, I was really sort of troubled by the position that companies were in trying to deal with this once in a blue moon potential threat that may never show up, but might show up. But if it does show up, and then on the other side of the equation, there's the daily just people beating at your down your door and trying to break in and steal little things. And they're more annoying. But if you don't deal with it, you'll have problems there too. And heaven forfend that both of those things happen at roughly the same time, which, by the way, is exactly how it tends to play out. This thing is happening all the time. And I started to hear from customers back in 2011, 2012, that, you know, they were using a third party to help with the day-to-day attacks, and they were using us at Mandiant to help with the nation state attacks. And the question was, why am I paying two vendors for what should essentially be one thing?
Yeah.
And that really stuck with me as I left FireEye. I was thinking about that. My co-founder, Dave Merkel, who actually pulled me over to Mandiant in the early days, I worked with him at AOL. So we've been married for over 21 years now, which is pretty wild to think about. But, you know, his thesis was, look, there's this managed services market. It's really big, right? People go to third parties for help with security in a variety of different flavors. And at Mandiant, we built an MDR, specifically managed detection response, but even more specifically focused on nation states. Is there a way to open up the aperture so that we can do high quality forensic response at speed and at scale, but not just nation states, for all of it? That was the question he was posing. And like, I immediately went to, well, yes, there is, and this is what we should do. And so three of us, Dave, myself, and Justin Byko, who I'd also worked with at Mandiant, he was at Symantec prior to that, the three of us did what I think you're supposed to do to start a startup, is we went to a bar and we started talking about it. And after about two drinks, we had convinced ourselves that we could do it.
Sure.
Yeah.
My last drinks may vary. Of all things, not a bar, but close enough. Falafel.
But we saw a real market problem. We saw an opportunity to solve it. I think there are aspects of the problem that are exactly the same, right? There's still nation state attackers. There are still day-to-day commodity conventional threats going on. And everything is changing, right? It's an industry of basically perpetual chaos where you've got evolving attackers, you've got evolving defenders, you've got evolving technology. We talk about cloud now in a way that's fundamentally different than we did even 10 years ago. Now we're talking about AI more, and what change does that bring to the playing field? And our goal was really to be Switzerland in the middle of all of that, right? Help customers integrate with whatever tech, help them migrate between tech, and keep up 24/7 operations without dropping an alert. And to do that transparently, so customers could see what we were up to at all times. That was the thing we set out to build, and that's, I think, the thing that we did create.
Excellent. And in terms of how Expel has worked with its customers, one thing I think is super interesting is you've got this fairly intimate security problem, right? Of course, companies use MSSPs for transactional kinds of security and risk problems, as opposed to more existential or very serious ones. That said, these companies are coming to you with a massive trust issue. They're going to a third party that they will depend on for something that it's not just like a compliance violation. If you guys mess it up, it's much more serious than that. How do we build trust with customers? What's the kind of culture that Expel has needed to cultivate internally to make all that work as a provider of such a high risk protective service?
Yeah, so I think there's two components to this. One is pretty generic, and it's the same way you build trust with anybody, is you set and meet expectations consistently. You do it over and over again. You're probably familiar with Brené Brown.
Yeah.
He has a really great metaphor. I think Stephen Covey calls it the emotional bank account, and Brené Brown calls it the trust bank. She has this jar of marbles metaphor where every time something goes well, every time you have a good interaction, you set an expectation and you met it. You put a marble in the jar, right? And that jar fills very, very slowly, but it does fill, and it's quite strong when it's full. Every time you mess up, which you will, right? We're human beings. We make mistakes. Every time you mess up, you reach in with your whole hand and pull out as many marbles as you can. We're just really mean to each other. Why? Trust builds really slowly, but you lose it really fast. And so I think part of it for us is to make sure that we're engaging well up front. Like, have the early days go well, be really crisp on setting expectations, meeting them, be tight on the execution. That's how you build trust initially. And then you need to keep that up over the long term. That needs to continue to be true. You make a mistake, you got to own it. Manager Tools, actually coming back to that, it has a really good podcast on how to apologize. Nails it. Exactly how you need to take ownership of mistakes that you made. So you've got to do that. That's the sort of more generic relationship and trust building that I think is really important. The second piece of it is transparency, which I mentioned earlier. In the managed security space, the transactional MSSPs that you were talking about, back when we started Expel, the criticism of that industry was it was a black box. And in fact, one of the heads of security, one of the CISOs that I talked to in the early days, had a quote that I thought was pretty damning. He said, yeah, MSSPs, those are the folks where you pour your money in, but nothing comes out.
Right.
I was like, and so it became really important to us at the get-go to prioritize transparency. We wanted to make sure that customers could see what we were doing all the time while we were doing it in real time. So there was nowhere to hide, which at the time was a little bit terrifying because I was like, am I going to be able to hire a security analyst? We're talking about somebody with just a few years of experience working out in the open in front of customers. And I was legitimately nervous about that. Like, will people take this job? But candidly, it's not substantively different than a company hiring their own security analyst. you're doing your work out in the open within the company. It just so happens we're doing the work out in the open for our customers, with our customers. It just makes the security analyst feel like more of the part of the team of our customers. So I think that's worked out particularly well. The other aspect of that, which was honestly a little bit accidental, is we only built one technology platform. You know, in the old days, I think you had the analyst console, or whatever you want to call it. You had the place where the analyst worked, and you had the portal. And something would shift the data into the portal for reporting to the customer, but never would you let the customer into the analyst tools. For us, as a startup, I'm like, well, that's expensive. Why would we build two of these? We had a CTO at the time who walked in one day and said, I really don't want to build two of them. It's expensive. Can I just build one? We thought about it. We're like, actually, that's maybe not a bad idea. Let's just build one thing and everybody can log into it and see what's happening in real time. That's what we did.
It's interesting. I'll bet you your analyst toolkit probably as a user interface probably is a hell of a lot better than the average bear as a result. Yeah. I think most people envision, you know, people who are working in analyst toolkits, they're just looking at code on a screen all day long. Probably doesn't make any sense to anybody except for analysts.
That's what the movies would have you think, right? And then you've got to be typing on two keyboards
at the same time with 17 screens.
Yeah.
Right. And a very dark room otherwise. No
one. Oh,
that's crucial. If we went to Expel's customers and we asked them, I mean, you built this thing up and we said, okay, well, what is it that is different about Expel that makes them indispensable for you? What are they talking about? What do they view as just absolutely, totally irreplaceable about what you guys are doing?
So there's a couple of things I think you're likely to hear. One is the industry cares about finding evil, finding it fast, and getting it off the network. And our ability to do that consistently, faster than you can deliver a pizza, is pretty much unmatched. So that consistency of execution, of accurately finding evil and getting it off the network, is pretty good, to the point where we had a customer several years ago. You remember, no doubt, when Russia invaded Ukraine.
Oh, yeah. Over somewhere. I'm not sure.
Back in 22, we had a customer reach out because they were about to sever ties with one of their partners, a Russian company. And it was fundamentally changing their risk profile. And they were like, I can't wait to analyze threats anymore. I need to assume compromise and I need to take systems off the network. And if we determine that it's not compromised, then we can put it back on the network. So from alert, just contain it and then uncontain it if it proves to be okay. So this is very much like a fire ready aim instead of a ready aim fire process for security operations, which is wild. And they came to us and said, can we do this? Which I thought was a pretty impressive ask. Because if we can't do an investigation very quickly, those machines are staying offline for a long time, which would significantly impact their business. We built that feature that day. We implemented it that afternoon. And that was 2022. It's still running to this day. Machines spend, I think the average is about 13 minutes off the network. And that's only because a bunch of people shut their laptops when they get contained. If they just left their laptops open, we could get them back online faster. But every once in a while. But that's speed. I think the speed is one thing that folks are really enthusiastic about.
Excellent.
The second thing that I think they would say is adaptability. We've had customers who need to switch from one piece of technology to another, or they do M&A, or they divest of a portion of their business. The change that they're dealing with is pretty much constant. And because we are agnostic when it comes to the technology that they use from a security standpoint, we can go with the flow. Security operations doesn't get touched while those changes are happening. In fact, we've had customers try two or three parallel vendors at the same time just to figure out which one works best.
Outstanding. You got to be proud of that. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
At this point in your career, you've probably been doing this more than most people have. You've seen a lot of change in security, generally speaking. You've alluded to a few of these. I mean, some of them are technology driven, some of them aren't. But I'd love to hear your take on just what you think the big pieces that have evolved the most since you started this. I mean, if you look across AOL, Mandiant, FireEye, Expel, I imagine some stuff is just astoundingly different than it was when you began. If you had to pick two or three things that are just wildly different, what would you point to?
Oh, man. It's a little bit of the more things change, the more they stay the same for me. If you look at any given attack surface, like take endpoint, roll back the clock, umpteen years, and we were working with logs. We were working with events. This thing happened. This thing happened. This thing happened. Were these things bad? I don't know, but they happened. All the work to figure out if things were bad, it was left to the reader. And then you had the rise of SIMs and correlation and all of that jazz. Nowadays, at least on the endpoint, we get high fidelity alerting. That didn't used to exist. Like the things that come out of modern endpoint detection response, EDR solutions is pretty good. And you have a handful of vendors you can pick from that deliver good quality. Several years ago, cloud comes out and we're back to events. We're really starting from scratch again, just in a different attack surface. You roll forward the clock. Okay, well, now we've got some CSPM technologies and we have Wiz and we have Orca and we have a variety of other things that are doing a way better job than we used to in the cloud. But the boundary is going away. So now everything's moving to identity. And then you start to see vendors follow the identity space. And I think every time this attack surface opens up, you're back at square one in terms of we have to start with events. We have to figure out what the bad stuff is. We need to figure out how to turn those into alerts and provide context and disposition them so that an analyst knows what to do about it. So that is the repeating pattern that I think I've seen. It's just a question of what's the latest attack surface. The most obvious one these days being AI, right?
Yeah, okay, good. I'll take a second and dig into that in a minute. But I think before we leave the what's changed thing, I guess, and it probably is related to AI too, conversely, what are the things that have risen and fallen as just pure hype in this space? Things that tend to attract a lot of attention and then flame out. What are a couple of your favorites?
You know, I'll probably point to a pattern here versus a favorite, and then you can point fingers. But the pattern, and I probably shouldn't have this recorded.
Now we edit it out if we have
to. Yeah. Do you watch South Park?
Oh, yes.
There was an old episode of South Park featuring the underpants gnomes.
I think I vaguely remember this.
They would run around town and steal underpants, and they lived in the caves under the town, under South Park. And there was a meeting they were having in one episode where there were a couple of people on stage and they had this PowerPoint behind them. And it was a three-step process of how they were going to win. And step one was steal underpants. And step two was question mark. And step three was profit.
That's the pattern.
It's the same pattern. The number of times I've seen, you know, first, we're going to some version of everything. You know, we're going to put all of our data here. And step two is just invent some jargon. And then step three is, you know, it's going to be amazing. We're going to hit it with the technology stick and everything's going to work out is something that you see again and again. And I think it manifests in the Gartner hype cycle, where we can literally track innovations moving through that.
We might be in another one.
Maybe.
I mean, it's possible. I guess this is a good time to kind of talk about that. Let's talk about where we are in the hype cycle. Yeah. You and I exchanged notes about AI and security operations a little bit before this. There are some important things and there's some hype things. I guess I'll just open with the broadest possible question here is, where are we on AI and security? And like, how would you characterize, maybe starting with the overall market space and how people are perceiving it, and then we can maybe start to break it down into what's real and what isn't?
So, you know, the overall market, I think, suffers from the law of averages, right? Like, you're going to have some people who are sort of turning their gimlet eye on AI and being skeptical, and you're going to have the true believers, and sort of averages out somewhere in the middle. From a broad market perspective, I think we're pretty close to peak.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like to
me.
So AI is not new, right, from a security standpoint. Generative AI is. Using large language models to do some of this work is pretty novel. But machine learning has been around for a while and been integrated into solutions and detection engineering and triage and investigations for some time now, and to good effectiveness as well. Yeah. But the thing to me about generative AI, and I do think this is evolving, I don't think this is going to be a forever problem, but Gen AI is really good at soft-edged problems and not so good at hard-edged problems. Those terms I'm stealing from a paper that came out a couple of years ago out of Stanford, where they're sort of describing soft-edge problems as those that have multiple correct answers. You know, you can draw a picture of a person, like any number of pictures of people, 100%, that's a person. but draw this person 70 times.
Right.
You can only do it right one way, and you have to do the same thing over and over again. The generative AI models are less good at that. That's not what they were really built to go do. And one of the challenges in security for me is, at least for certain parts of the problem, you have to be right. You can't just be plausible. So I think where we apply generative AI is very, very important in the overall workflow of security operations. So, you know, offloading manual and sort of menial information gathering and investigative tasks, frankly, you can handle all that with automation. And maybe you can bolster it with AI to say, oh, and grab other related stuff you think might be useful. Cool. Presenting information, organizing it in a way that people can look at it and make sense of it. It does a pretty good job of doing that because there's lots of correct ways that you can do that to be effective. Generating investigation reports, writing prose with the right analyst input, explaining why something is benign. Like, those are really, really great use cases to accelerate the work of security operations. But leaving it unchecked for something like, is this evil or not? A little dangerous. Because if you think about how often you have to be right, for hard edge problems, a 99% success rate is failure, and that's security operations.
When you think about how those mistakes play out, if you see companies that are applying it as a substitute for judgment in these 4+ sigma situations where you cannot make mistakes, describe a consequence. Like, if a company does this and they lean too hard on it, what are some of the bad things that could happen?
I mean, the easy answer is you let something by that you should have actioned, and the attacker has more time to do things in the environment. That's the ultimate price to be paid. You invariably find out too late.
So it's a time thing. And you're coming back to the speed, which is your bread and butter, which is you have to be fast in this.
You have to be fast, and you have to be right. And you have to be consistently right and fast.
Are there signs that there are developments in specific kinds of models that could be more effective on hard edge problems? Or is it just, we haven't seen any evidence of that yet?
No, there definitely is. So, you know, I think a lot of the Gen AI stuff started off as imitation models. You know, you take a pattern and you imitate it and you follow it. Yeah, exactly. Imitation models are really fine as long as the input data matches the training data. What happens with imitation models, though, is when the input data starts to veer off from the training data, the model doesn't know what to do anymore and it makes really weird decisions.
Yeah.
There was a really good write-up on this that they were basically watching how imitation models performed doing sort of like Mario Kart. And the AI would drive really, really well until it got a little bit off center and then would just careen off the side of the track. The degradation of decision-making was pretty dramatic. But there's also reinforcement learning. You know, when you do something wrong, you feed that back in and say, hey, that's wrong. It's just that reinforcement learning is super expensive. Yeah. And so selling everybody a reinforcement learning model is kind of not the way. The architecture is a little more like you have these imitation models and they're all subsidiary to a reinforcement model that keeps them in check and keeps the learning models learning. And in that architecture, you could sell the learning models would just get smarter over time. And I think that architecture is likely to help us in the long term put more and more in the hands of the AI to do decision making. But over the short term, over the immediate term, you absolutely need humans in the loop to make sure that the right thing is happening.
On the flip side of this, and I'd be curious whether you think this is an overhype or not. Obviously, nation state actors, but not just nation state actors. I mean, they're working the flip side of this, right? They're trying to figure out how to use sophisticated models to defeat defenses. What is your take on where those adversaries are, whether that's something we should be worried a little bit about or a lot about? Is it more than just compressing the time between playbooks, or is it really more fundamental than that? What's your take?
You know, it's going to be really hard for this not to come across as FUD, but it's really a problem.
Yeah. We just had the Chinese attack 2 weeks ago.
Exactly. And we're seeing two things happening at once. One, pretty disturbing trend of fully functional applications that are now being shipped with hidden backdoors. Like, Bowloader accounted for, I think, 13% of the non-targeted malware we saw last quarter, baked into tools that otherwise worked. They're just along for the ride. And so you've got, you know, legitimate productivity apps that are putting backdoors in your network. And the ability for attackers to do that, like the barrier to entry for doing something like that has significantly dropped because of some of this help that we're getting from AI. The other thing that, you know, you can't help but talk about, and I think this is what you were talking about before, was the use of Anthropic by the Chinese to orchestrate attacks at, I think, a speed and scale that we've never seen before. And that just so happens because, and one person's opinion here, but like Claude Code is a really, really good orchestration platform. You know, you'd think, well, why don't they use their own AI? Because it does a pretty good job. And their ability to essentially trick it into doing the attack for them, honestly, remarkable.
And is the scale in accessible compute also, I mean, to me, in another project that I'm working on, I'm sort of astonished by the fact that I can spin up 100 GPUs to go solve a problem in reinforcement learning on my own with really no training for not a lot of money. And if I had a little bit more money, it would be astonishing on a platform like Brev or something like that, that I could just deploy whatever I wanted onto it. Yeah. Notwithstanding the quality of the code, let's assume the quality of the code is good. The computing power that just a random guy can get a hold of to do potentially nefarious things seems a little terrifying to me. I mean, you know, I'm quite imaginative on these things, so I might get getting away from myself. But what's your take on the hardware availability?
Yeah, the accessibility of the tools to do this is, I mean, trivial. It's you can walk down to the supermarket and get some. It's that easy.
It feels like buying a Target gift card.
Yeah, except you don't have to walk anywhere. You can do it from your house. You can do it from your living room. So that is honestly pretty impressive. But it's also the same house of cards that everything else is sitting on. And this is a place where I really don't know how things are going to play out. The innovation that's happening in AI is being bankrolled by a number of organizations, and we're not paying what we should be paying for.
Yeah.
Because it is subsidized. And at some point, those subsidies presumably go away. And then what happens? And so this is where I see a little bit of relationship with the dot-com boom and bust and why we don't see Global Crossing and WorldCom anymore. The main difference between back then and now, in my mind, is that the companies that are some of the biggest companies in the history of capitalism. And so they can bankroll something like this, and they can lose a lot of money on it in the short term in order to see the benefits in the long term. So the chances that those companies disappear right now, probably lower. But newer entrants that are building entirely new businesses based on the premise of building on top of these capabilities using subsidized tokens, things may be a little more difficult for them when the market equalizes.
Yeah. And it's really interesting to figure out where the constraint is that is driving the real price of this stuff that we're not paying. I mean, my hunch is that it's energy. It's no in small. I mean, that seems to be a massive choke point. And it's not like that can just be fixed. It's not like you can just get a new entrant who figures out how to make everything cheaper. You got to literally split a bunch of atoms or something, or put up a giant solar array or dig a well. These are not.
Or all of the above.
Oh, yes. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
But it's real. Like, it's real from a tax standpoint. It's real from a defense standpoint. Like, it does actually help on the defense side quite a bit. I think one of the funniest things, I'll end sort of the AI on a little bit of a humorous note, is when humans make a mistake, you can look at the mistake and be like, okay, I can see why somebody made that mistake. That makes sense. I mean, bad mistake, but come on. When an AI makes a mistake, they're hilarious. You look at it and you're like, what even? So that's just, it's the advantage of having a little bit of comic relief while we integrate AI into our workflows these days.
Well, that makes me feel a little bit better, is that if everything goes sideways, it's probably going to be hilarious.
It'll at least be
going to be great. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, we kind of started talking about economics a little bit. Let's continue to pull the finance and economics thread. And I'd love to hear your take on the sort of CISO, CFO, security leader, finance leader dichotomy. And this is something that actually comes up a ton on this podcast. Like, every single guest that I have, it's this conversation, and not only cyber, it's also physical and pretty much everything under the sun, of this problem of finance and risk, especially risks that seem to a finance person to be, you know, implausible or unlikely, but potentially really, really bad. How do you think about this? We had to coach clients on how to talk to their CFOs about why this is worth it. How do you all approach this problem? How do you think about making the financial case for security?
Yeah, so it's at Expel a couple of months ago, we ran a survey across 300 or so leaders. I want to say they were roughly split 50-50 between CISOs and CFOs. And we were trying to figure out, you know, how well are they communicating and are they aligned and do they look at the problems the same way and are they getting what they want out of, you know, each other kind of thing, as we were trying to explore this gap that we keep talking about that exists, this gulf that exists between security leaders and CFOs or other business leaders. And what we came away with was sort of as a bottom line, finance doesn't see security as just a cost because they want to or they're unsupportive. They see it that way because security hasn't learned to articulate the value in the terms as the finance leader can understand, which isn't, it's not a budgeting problem. It's a communication and education problem. It's a language problem. And that, I mean, that hit home to me pretty strongly. When I was at AOL, I mentioned earlier, I remember being in a meeting where the finance team came to visit our security operations group and was walking us through the P&L. And at the time, I was kind of alarmed at the questions that other leaders in my department were asking because it belied a fundamental lack of understanding of what was being presented. And I thought to myself, well, gosh, if I am going to stay in management, I should know the answers to these questions. And so it was one of the major things in my life that prompted me to go to grad school. And I did that primarily to flesh out my finance knowledge. And that proved really helpful. Like that enabled me to go do more business ownership things and be responsible for P&L and all that jazz. And it bridged that language divide. And I think that divide is something that we're really struggling with in the security industry right now.
No question about it. It's interesting to me how, I mean, we've had cyber folks, we've had physical security folks, visitor management, straight guards, you know, some who are just generalist government leaders. The financial literacy in all flavors of security is astonishingly poor. It's just not, and I think I understand it on some levels because there is never a point in security where, unless you're selling a product on our side, like you have the company, you're trying to sell a product to somebody, that's one thing, but a practitioner, there is no revenue line. Like that's not part of the equation. These two groups just do not know how to talk to each other. The best that we ever came up with, and as fair as I could tell, it seemed to work about half the time, was to begin to talk about things like an insurance agent would, which, you know, what's the probability of a bad thing happening? And that sort of works, but it only gets you so far with a CFO who can eventually write off a sub 5% probability risk is something that's not worth investing in. And they just blow it off. So are there techniques that you have found particularly effective when you know, as somebody who studied finance a little bit, and trying to talk to a financial decision maker on whether to make an investment, whether it's an Expel or something else, is there something that seems to work more often than not to persuade them that this is worth it, even though it's a sub 5% probability event? What seems to work for you?
The thing that works is when the security leaders engage directly with the CFOs. Build that relationship.
Yeah, human.
Spend the time. Have the conversation human to human. Start talking about not whether you're in budget or out of budget or how to get more budget, but talk about what's important. What are you worried about? What risks concern you? What hurts the business? Understand how you make money. Like all of those kinds of conversations are really going to help build a stronger relationship. We actually saw this come out in the report, as I recall, for CISOs who said that they had built strong relationships with their CFOs, we got about 20 more points of like, they both said we are more aligned than the ones who didn't. So that's probably the most material. The second, and then more specific in that conversation is spend time understanding what the business risks are. The vast majority of CISOs said that their priorities matched business goals. And more than half of them said they weren't sure if their investments aligned with business risk. Mm. That's the same question.
Yeah.
But those are very different answers. And, you know, understanding that I think is an issue.
This is a strange question because the answer should be obviously yes. Do you think security leaders and finance leaders, either or both, understand what the word risk means consistently? I mean, when I think about it, because I have a little bit of finance background, I think about it as a math problem for the most part. which is probability and consequence. Do you think they think about it that way? Or does the word just kind of get lost in a nebulous sea of goo?
I think there's a fundamental truth that a lot of leaders, and I don't even want to pick on security leaders here, I think a lot of leaders in general sort of miss, is the language of business is finance. And so whatever you're talking about, if it's a thing, it has a dollar in always. And it's a dollar coming in or it's a dollar going out. And risks are dollars going out. Yeah. And so if you can't articulate it as we managed to not make these dollars go out, we're not talking about risk.
Reducing the dollars going out.
Yeah.
When you talk about risk, and maybe reframe it, just say it again so that I don't botch it. But when you think about what risk means in terms of dollars, and you're explaining CFOs, say that line again.
If you're not talking about risk in terms of preventing dollars from going out, then you're not talking about risk.
There you go. Preventing dollars from going out. If all attacks fundamentally are dollars going out.
Dollars going out. And it'll go out in a variety of forms. And your comment earlier about talking about it as insurance, little bit of pros and cons there, because you can, you know, buy an insurance policy for your car that'll fix your car if something goes wrong. But I mean, there's the real-time work of addressing the breach. There's the wear and tear on the people. There's the reputational damage. There's the customer impact, potential churn that it might create. Like, the lingering effects can be pretty significant to a business, and really wrapping a rope around that is all tough. Have you ever heard of the book, How to Measure Everything in Cybersecurity Risk?
I've heard of it. I have not read it, but I've heard pretty rave things about it, actually.
I mean, if you want to talk to a CFO, that's the
book.
Way to do it. That's
I should probably pick it up. All right. It's on my list now. It's interesting you mentioned, before we leave the insurance thing, since you brought it up, I think maybe I brought it up, but my sense of, and I'm sure you guys are involved in this, because pricing of policies is something that usually involves how much data you're handling, what kind of data it is, which of course your clients are probably getting a lot of that data from you or your help. My sense of the insurance market for cybersecurity insurance is that it's better than it was 10 years ago, and it's still not good. Like, the way these policies are priced and how they do it, it's still a bit of a mess. What is your take?
I think that's accurate. I mean, if we look back a few years, the cyber insurance market was very much in land grab mode.
Yeah.
I mean, they were writing policies that would just sign up the customers, get them on. And as the claims started coming in and real actuarial data was starting to show up, they're starting to make some different decisions about, okay, how are we going to write these policies? And I think we're seeing the consequence of that. Policies are the scar tissue of an organization. I mean, that's true for insurance companies too, at other people's scar tissue into black and white.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Okay, let's shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about leadership. I mean, we touched on manager tools a little bit earlier, which is maybe part of it. Across the companies that you've worked on and the clients that you've worked with that seem to be getting this right, what are really good security leaders get right? What are some things that you see in their behavior?
I think one, they speak the language of business. So that is the language of finance, yes. But more importantly, they connect the technical capabilities to business outcomes. And again, those business outcomes are going to be dollars. And if you can draw that relationship, the customers that we work with that do that well have tremendous control over their budgets and tremendous credibility with their peers and the board.
How do they tend to get it? What's the pattern? Because this is not necessarily a natural skill that you would build as a security leader. You're not often asked to learn it. I mean, in some cases, you go back and get a degree, and that might be helpful a little bit, but it might not be, depending on where you get it from.
Yeah.
How do people typically acquire it that you've seen? Is it by putting themselves in the right room? Is it about building relationships, independent study? What's the hook?
I don't think there's a single path. I think people have taken different roads there. Some people do go to school to flesh out some of that knowledge. Some people get coaches. Some people have peers or mentor networks that help them with that kind of stuff. The more senior you get in your role, the more communication becomes important. The quality of your work restricted entirely by the quality of your communication. Because if you do work and can't communicate it, you can't perceive the value of that work. And I think that is a major barrier for leaders, especially, and security is tough because it's an extremely technical discipline. And so you're spending a lot of time with practitioners and going into the weeds on stuff, none of which is in finance language. And then building that bridge is a totally different communications pattern.
Is it, to some extent, and there's a curious question, aside from business, Security for, I mean, obviously, if you're in cyber, it tends to be focused on technical problems. And by technical, in this case, I mean computer science problems, computer engineering, but because that's where we're coming from. A few of the folks that I've been super impressed by just in the course of having these conversations, because I get to talk to all kinds of different people who have very different backgrounds than I do, I'm often struck by the ones who are conversant in a lot of different security disciplines. Some of that's because some of the clients we had were national security, like, you know, Trisha Stokes is one who we had on a few weeks ago. She ran Army security, which is a little bit of everything, including training and physical and all kinds of incident response. There's an emergency management component for a lot of these folks. When you think about those kind of folks who are working on things like actual guns, gates, and guards, and also have cyber in their portfolio, how important is that as a leader? Do you think that matters much as a security leader? If it does matter, what are the things that maybe some security leaders need to learn that they're not learning?
So, you know, this connects directly with the previous question you asked was, what are the patterns that I see that lead to security leaders being really effective? Roughly, that's how I remember the question. One of them was speaking the language of the business. The second one is building relationships across the C-suite.
Yeah.
You know, getting to know the different leaders that run the business and what they care about and how they think about things. And one of those leaders is invariably going to have the scope of caring about the physical security. And there is an intersection there between, you know, physical and cybersecurity, which we've seen. You can hire companies to come in and break into the network and drop some USB keys and some CDs around. I guess you don't drop CDs around anymore because nobody has CD players. One of the, you know, red teams we caught a few years ago actually had wired up a wireless access point under a table in the mall hallway across from the retail store, walked into the retail store, found the password, stickied onto the POS, walked back out to the hallway, connected their wireless to the store's wireless, broke into the store, used the store to hop up into the cloud infrastructure, went into the enterprise environment, started stealing data. Fully connected physical cyber attack chain. So it happens.
And when we got acquired by Sign-In, that was one of the things that I got to speed up because we were mostly working on knowledge problems and cyber and compliance problems. And I'm coming into an organization that was primarily doing visitor management. And it wasn't really until then that I fully appreciated the connection between physical access and human access to facilities and physical spaces as an additional attack service that is incredibly important. And I honestly didn't pay very much attention to it because that wasn't the part of the problem we were solving. But full attack chain suite, I mean, you know, I imagine that that's what the most sophisticated adversaries are doing. Like, why wouldn't you include visitors and physical spaces as part of a coordinated attack? It seems to make a hell of a lot of sense.
I'm sure you've heard. I don't know that there are any organizations in the U.S. that hasn't had an employee that wasn't real show up for work, you know, start to get access to corporate systems. I mean, you've got to be thinking about what's going on in the hiring pipeline to understand that risk, because the line between insider threat and outsider threat is just getting fuzzier as we go.
Yeah, excellent. Well, let's shift to some more fun, quick, rapid fire things to close the conversation. So the first one's gonna be easy. What's your favorite thing about Northern Virginia, Yannick?
Food. Easily.
Well, that's going to tee up a second one, which is favorite restaurant.
Oh, you know, I got to say, there was this restaurant just around the corner from my house that was a Burmese. And yeah, so take a little bit of Indian, take a little bit of Thai, because that's where it is in the world. And you've got Burmese food. No influences for both. Shut down during COVID.
Oh, man.
But it was not just my favorite restaurant in the area. It was my favorite restaurant on the planet.
That is, if you ask me, what is the thing I miss most about being in the DC area, it's 100% is food. There's no question about it. My mother-in-law is in town right now fixing Indian food for me. And that's as close as I get. It's just not the same. Charlotte's pretty good, but it's just not. You can't walk into Adams Morgan and just get anything, which I miss.
I enjoyed the food truck when we were down there for meetings.
DC is on another level. All right. More security-related one. And we've touched on this a little bit. Most overhyped trend. What is the most overhyped thing right now that drives you nuts?
AI is the most overhyped, but also the most underhyped at the same time.
Right. But it's going to be sort of like the internet in 1999. You're spot on. Probably is going to change the world. And it is very annoying right now.
Yeah, it's probably a bigger seismic shift than the internet was.
It's like that loudmouth friend that, you know, never shuts up, but you know that they're right.
They'll eventually be right.
What's the one metric that SOC leaders should stop paying attention to that they are focused too much time on?
Okay, SLAs.
Interesting. Say more about that.
So a lot of SOC leaders want their analysts to make decisions in a certain amount of time. If you want your analyst to make a decision in a certain amount of time, but that's not what you want.
Yeah.
You want the right decision, and you want to reduce the amount of time it takes them to make the right decision. But by setting a, you have to make a decision in this time frame is the wrong way to go about that.
Yeah. It's a little bit to what you mentioned earlier about, you know, the decisions that cannot be wrong. I mean, in a certain amount of time, you'll get an answer. That's excellent.
Watch how long it takes an analyst to make a decision, but fixing that is not, like, don't make the analyst fix that problem. Fix the process around them, fix the technology around them, make changes to try to drive that number down.
Got it. Best security book or resource, doesn't necessarily have to be a book, I guess, from more than 5 years ago. So something that's not recent that is your go-to.
Did you say fiction or nonfiction?
Either. Best, I'll open it up. Not necessarily a security book. I'll say anything adjacent to running a security operation. So it could be a non-security book that just teaches us things that we need to know. That any book or resource not written in the last 5 years, something a little older than last week.
Well, I don't know that I have something specific to security operations, but if I think about sort of security oriented things that I've read in the past, the first thing that comes to mind several years ago, this is actually fiction and doesn't help with security operations at all, but it's a book called Freedom by Daniel Suarez.
Yeah.
Maybe a rough time to read it right now because the machines got really smart and they're killing us. But it's a murder mystery. It's really well written.
Oh, man. It's like the old episodes of The Simpsons from 20 years ago where, you know, Trump's head in a jar is president. They're right about a shocking number of things. So hopefully the murder bots is not one of those things. If you've got a young analyst starting today, like literally out of college, assuming that they can get a job, which is difficult these days, what would you tell them to focus on? Really hard problem right now, I think.
One, same advice as always, go deep on everything you possibly can. Like, don't learn breadth, learn depth. And then two, learn the hell out of everything AI you can. Because you're not going to lose your job to AI, but you will lose your job to somebody who knows AI better than you do.
It's interesting. And I know our kids are roughly the same ages. It seems like there's a little bit of irritation or hostility to AI among kids that use it. They don't necessarily view it as a career imperative. Mostly it seems like they view it as a way to either cheat or whatever the thing is, which is really unfortunate. I'm interested to see, and again, the parallels to 99, 2000 are just over and over again. What are the cultural imperatives for how we behave with this technology that just need to be part of how we think about how you solve every problem all the time?
I think it comes back to what you were saying earlier, is there are some foundational things that remain important. You know, you don't get out of critical thinking. And I think a lot of the stigma that comes along with AI and it's tied to cheating and stuff like that comes from educational institutions.
Yeah, without
it. I remember I spent a good half hour with my kid once because she had to write an email. And I'm like, okay, let's go to the AI. She's like, really? You're going to tell me to use AI? I'm like, yeah, because it's going to draft something that's okay. And you're going to fix it far faster than you were going to draft something that's not very good.
Well, listen, this has been a lot of fun. I want to give you a chance to close up and tell everybody, if they want to learn more about Excel, how do they do that? What's the best way?
Excel.com, right? We've got a website. It's the best place to start. Talk to the folks. Get a demo. We will actually take customers and put them on the platform before ever signing a contract because it's that easy. The first customer we ever onboarded themselves in the matter of hours. We designed it that way. It's really easy to get up and running these days. The old days of working with a third party and 6 to 9 month implementation plan, nobody's got time for that.
Yeah, that's great.
So get up and running fast or come by the next show, you know, Black Hat, RSA.
You're all the big ones. I know you are. Those are the two that everybody probably knows you from. What's your next one?
I think RSA is next, right? I think it's later this year.
All right, last word. What's the one thing you want everybody to take away about what the problems that they are facing that they need to remember from this conversation?
You know, I think that the number one bit of advice I would have is accept the things that you don't know and then go figure them out. It's okay not to know.
Excellent. All right. Yannick, thank you. It's a delight as always. Glad we got a chance to talk.
Likewise, John, it's been too long.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us on Secure Access, brought to you by Sinon Solutions. If you found today's conversation insightful, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. For more on transforming compliance, security, and workplace experiences, visit signinsolutions.com. Until next time, stay secure, stay informed.